I came to think about depression as a wilderness experience by really just following the narratives of depression sufferers themselves. I was seeing how depression sufferers were talking about their own experiences as this sort of displacement into a harsh and inhospitable landscape, into an unhome-like world. How might thinking about different types of wilderness stories in the Bible help me kind of process maybe different ways that God is relating to this condition, rather than constraining or delimiting possibilities for theological reflection? It actually opens it up.
Jessica Koblentz is an assistant professor of religious studies and theology at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. With Daniel Horan, she co-edited a volume titled The Human in a Dehumanizing World, Reexamining Theological Anthropology and Its Implications. She's also the author of another book published just this year by Liturgical Press, a book we discussed today, Dust in the Blood, A Theology of Life with Depression. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Jessica, how are you? It's good to see you.
So good to be with you. Thanks so much, Matt.
You're good to take the time. You know, I ask my guests how faith figures into their life and work. And in your case, I'm wondering whether you've always considered yourself a person of faith and what it was that prompted you to take up a career as an academic theologian.
Yeah, thanks. I have always been a person of faith. I was raised by my parents in the Catholic Church, and we were regular Sunday Mass goers and went to Sunday schools and things like that. Looking back on my childhood, I realized, though, that our Catholic life didn't permeate much of the home or our life outside of the parish on Sunday, which was a contrast to, I know, a lot of other Catholics, but also a lot of the other folks that I grew up around. I grew up in the Seattle area, which is known for being quite secular, but I went to public schools where I encountered a lot of people of different Christian denominations, other faith traditions. And I think I've always been a person with a sort of religious disposition. I've always had sort of questions about God and just sort of marveled at the world's big questions. And so as I grew up, I started to notice that a lot of the people around me, a lot of my friends at school, were members of churches and religions that engaged with their faith lives through study, through, you know, whether it's Bible study or more regular religious education than what I got, kind of more personal conversations about their faith lives than what I was used to. And I think that made me very, very curious about how other people engaged this kind of religious stirring that I always had. And so it made me a really, like, kind of religiously curious teenager. I had friends who were reading books about God, some of them theological books, although I didn't have the language for that at the time. And so I kind of started to dabble in that and got it in my head as a teenager that I wanted to go to college somewhere where I could kind of take classes in religion and philosophy, or what I thought religion and philosophy would be, because this sort of kind of intellectual exploration of faith really appealed to me. And it wasn't something that I had access to from my upbringing or my schooling. So I was really lucky to go to a college where my first quarter there, I had this fantastic theology class, and I was just in love. I felt like it really brought together that religious stirring and my intellectual question. And the rest is history, I guess. I was sold, and I didn't know what a theologian was. I didn't know what a college professor was. I didn't know about research, but that sort of was an entree into what has been my trajectory since then.
Okay. That leads to this question then. That's kind of a happy story in some ways about how you found a vocation, how you found a sense of the religious, the spiritual, in a way that was sort of personally implicating to you, which is it's a nice story, I think. Let's talk then about the origins of your book, Dust in the Blood, Theology of Life with Depression, because the origins here, I'm going to imagine, are not quite as rosy. And I'm specifically interested in what it was in you that led you to think you had something to say about depression and why you decided to pursue, you know, this book rather than some other kind of book you might have written.
Yeah, there were intellectual questions that are longstanding that led me to this book. There were also personal experiences that led me to this book. Since I started studying theology, I've been really fascinated with questions of suffering. I know realities of suffering are what bring a lot of people to ask big theological questions. But for me, I've always been really fascinated with how religion can be a source of great pain and harm to a lot of people, a source of suffering. And it can also be a healing source, something that animates a person's life in really positive ways. I think that's been my own experience in many ways. So I've always had that intellectual kind of fascination, and that guided a lot of my education in theology over the years. But then when I was beginning my doctoral work, I found myself with a very severe bout of depression, and it kind of almost ended my graduate studies. And it just brought a different kind of urgency and a sort of personal stake to this longstanding intellectual interest. So when I fortunately started to come out of that, my depression lessened, and I started to think about continuing in my doctoral work. I found that I kind of couldn't shake this experience that I had, but I also was starting to see how this experience could actually allow me to enter into these longstanding questions about suffering in a way that was needed in the broader community. You know, if depression was just my problem, it wouldn't be worth a book, I think. But the more I started looking, the more I saw great need for more theological treatments of mental health conditions broadly and depression in particular. So I didn't know right away what I would say about it, but I knew that it was a worthwhile undertaking, not only for myself on a kind of personal level, but the work that I would put in could potentially serve a need for a lot of people and for the church as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. That is an interesting story you just told, you know, because kind of where the personal and the intellectual really kind of intersect, right, is where this book comes from for you. And it is a book that has, I think, speaks not just to depression, but also to suffering more generally. It gets into the issue of theodicy, explanations for suffering, etc., and in ways that are very subtle. And let's talk about the book. So to give our listeners a feeling for its flow, right, it begins by describing what depression is and how it feels. And then it moves to popular Christian theologies of depression, discusses some criticisms of these same theologies. And that's part one of the book. Right. So in part two, you propose a couple biblical images and narratives for considering depression, and you discuss the importance of discipleship alongside depression sufferers. And you light on a word to describe the experience of depression. The word is unhomelikeness. Now, that jumped out to me because that's a literal translation of a German word. I don't speak German, but, you know, Unheimlichkeit, you know, that is usually translated as uncanny. What made you choose the less familiar but more literal translation, unhomelikeness, to describe depression?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that fascinated me as I started to learn more about depression, which I did first through just reading a lot of memoirs of people who have lived with depression, I discovered how difficult it was to articulate this experience. You have these, you know, sometimes brilliant, acclaimed, Pulitzer Prize winning writers saying, like, I don't have the words to talk about how difficult this experience is. And one of the things I started to notice is that they over and over again reached for figurative language to articulate what this experience was like. And very often I was struck by how sufferers describe their experience as a sort of dislocation into another world. This is not just a change in their ordinary experience, it is something else entirely. And I started to ask myself, you know, why is it that's, what is it about this condition that leads people to talk about it in these sort of spatial terms? And in my kind of search for greater understanding, I happened upon this body of literature in philosophy that's a sort of phenomenology of depression, a sort of study of what this experience is like. This approach to studying experience phenomenology has this really rich vocabulary for talking about some of the more elusive dimensions of human experience. And this term, which I literally translate, as you say, is unhomelikeness, is one of these terms that phenomenology uses to talk about certain experiences that people have, including you know, many depression sufferers, where they experience a real shift in the kinds of possibilities that are available to them as they move throughout the world. And, you know, as you mentioned, often this is translated as uncanny in English, the sort of uncanniness that people experience. But to me, the literal translation, unhomelikeness, retains that kind of spatial shift that I was seeing emerge in the more everyday kind of vernacular descriptions of depression, this dislocation into another world. So I wanted to hold on to that. And actually, in a lot of the philosophical literature on depression that I engage in the book, they actually tend to also translate it as unhomelikeness. So I felt like there's some precedent for it, and I was going to go with it.
Yeah, good. It the term works for the reasons you just described, you just laid out. Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's a good translation given those conditions you're describing in the book. And it's also kind of an unfamiliar term, which kind of captures the unfamiliarity of depression, the defamiliarizing effect mm-hmm. of this terrible dislocation you're describing. I want to come back yes. to something you said earlier. You talked about your interest when you were younger and how religion can both cause and heal suffering. Because there's a question mm-hmm. at the end of a comment I've got here. You remark in the book that depression isolates people who experience it, right? It deprives them of feelings of belonging. And for this reason, things that can connect sufferers' depression to systems of meaning, you know, cultural frameworks that give us explanation for why we suffer or purpose in our suffering, these things are especially important. And theology, especially when theology is practiced in religious settings, is a powerful cultural framework of meaning, of belonging, right, and connection to people and the sense of life's purpose. So one would think, right, it would be beneficial to those who experience depression. And yet, and this is back to what you said earlier, as you put it, I'm quoting you here, religious leaders and systems sometimes fail to offer consolation and instead engender new crises. Okay, why is this?
Yeah, I think, like you said, because religion can be such an important animating feature of a person's communal life and their self-understanding, when religion kind of fails a person, it can feel really, really difficult. And especially in the depression memoirs of Christian sufferers that I read, I noticed that time and time again, people were describing how they were having this, you know, really, really difficult experience of depression. And they would turn to these faith communities, you know, for answers to big questions that many of us ask when we're really struggling. You know, why is this happening to me? Where is God? What, as a Christian person, should I do? with this suffering that I'm stuck in. What's happening to me? They were turning to these communities for accompaniment and sometimes answers to these questions. And often, instead of getting that kind of accompaniment kind of resources that aligned with their experience, that met them where they were receiving sometimes what felt like dismissive messages, people telling them, this is what your depression is caused by. You must be a sinner. This must be a demon. You must have done something to make yourself vulnerable to this, or, you know, this is God's plan. And often these messages are delivered with sincerity. They're delivered to, you know, sort of offer an answer to these questions that sufferers have. But instead of helping, often people felt like they were ignoring the reality of depression that they were amidst. And so to have that kind of religious disappointment on top of the suffering that the depression sufferers were already experiencing, just sort of magnified this isolation that is a very, very real part of the condition for so many people.
Yeah, okay. Do you think that depression intimidates those who see others suffering from it? I ask this, you know, because I thinking about the effect of watching suffering on others and how that can make us really, I think, fear and tremble a bit in the, you know, wondering why these things are happening to other people that can make us less secure in our own interpretations of the world. Quick story. So there's a guest right now at the Humanities Center we're having yesterday and today. His name is Jimmy Baca. He's a very well-known poet, especially. He kind of burst into the scene in the 1970s. He was writing from prison. And he was writing about these intense, awful prison experiences, and he began to get published writing things in prison and sending them out to these magazines. And he had a kind of a benefactor who was kind of connected to the outside world, who was in, you know, sort of a very kindly, godly man, you know, at one point, Baca was expressing to this man who would send him things, books, you know, send him letters of encouragement. Baca was expressing how he just could not believe in God, given how the brutality that he witnessed in the prison. It was so awful, the violence that he witnessed. And this man wrote him and said, "This is the last letter you're going to get from me. You're causing me to doubt my faith. So I'm very sorry, and I wish you well, and that's it." And Baca says now he believes in God, actually. but at the time, he didn't. And the way he was talking caused this man to doubt. That's a long way of asking this question. Do you think that depression causes others to doubt?
I think it can. And, you know, this one of my favorite kind of passages written by Pope Francis comes to mind with this question. In his 2018 apostolic exhortation, Gaudete et Exultate, which is a letter on holiness in the modern world. There's a section where Francis sort of interprets the Beatitudes for today. And in his reflection on Blessed Are the Mourning, he writes about how, particularly in our very kind of fast-paced and distracted world, it is so easy to indulge our desire to turn away from suffering. We can distract ourselves from the pain of others, often our own pain. Anything that is uncomfortable, that calls into question anything we don't really want to grapple, we can distract ourselves from it. And he says, the holy person is the one who can look the sufferer in the face and who can sit with him or her and bear with their pain and sort of stay with the fact that it's not immediately fixable. It doesn't immediately make sense often, you know. And I have that passage on my door, the door of my office, because I just think it's such an insightful observation about the challenge of accompanying those who suffer in our time. It's so easy to turn away precisely because of the discomfort that it rouses in so many of us.
That's profound. You know, it really brings to mind for me that so much about being able to sit with suffering is also about being able to wait patiently on God, and to not have to need to have an answer in the moment, not have to need to have one's faith met with some kind of sign or fulfillment in the moment, that sitting with suffering really is about sitting in ambiguity.
Yes.
Yeah. To that end, then, I guess, you point out that there are a couple of common explanations people who have depression hear from others. One is there must be some kind of moral ill you've committed. You brought this on yourself, you know, snap mm-hmm. out of it, repent, change your ways, etc. And the other is that God has some kind of divine reason, you know, some great reason why God's giving this to the sufferer. And it seems pretty clear why people experiencing depression would not like to be told that they've made some kind of grave moral error that brought this on. But I think that sometimes people who don't suffer depression think, oh, if I can just convince this person that there's a lesson they're going to gain from it, that it's all to their good, that this will make it better somehow. And you point out in the book, not necessarily.
That's right. And I agree. I think it's more common, at least in the circles that I run in, certainly, to hear people say things like, everything happens for a reason. God must have put this in your life for some good. This is your cross to bear. It's these sort of messages of what in theology we'd call redemptive suffering, something good, you know, will come from this, are often meant as messages of encouragement, right? They're meant to urge the sufferer not to despair, that something good will emerge from this. But as you mentioned, a lot of people, when they're in the midst of grave suffering, including depression, where, you know, there often seems to be no way out of it. The sufferer is trying to improve her situation. It's not working. She can't control it. And it often sort of resists meaning. You know, the ways that people sort of regularly, often unthinkingly, make meaning of their lives just seem really, really difficult to a lot of people amid depression. And so to hear that this is actually a good thing, or, you know, just look on the bright side, there's got to be some reason that God is doing this, can feel like, first of all, just a denial of the reality that the person is living in. It can feel very, very dismissive. But also, you know, there's some troubling theological implications that follow from these messages. If you think about it, I mean, to some people, this casts a vision of a sort of masochistic God. Why is God not teaching me this lesson that I'm supposed to be getting from this some other way? Why do I have to be tortured by depression in order to grow closer to God, to become a better person or something? That is a really kind of really, really troubling question that a lot of people struggle with when they're handed these messages, particularly in these sort of prescriptive terms, which unfortunately is how a lot of people receive them. This is, you know, it's not the sort of invitational conversation where people are sitting together grappling with the difficulty of this condition. These things are often said well-meaningly, but kind of dismissively to people.
Yeah. You know, I do not experience clinical depression, but I have had episodes in my life when I experienced many of the same symptoms and for a prolonged period of time. And I remember in one case, it was a case of mourning for a friend who died. And I remember feeling really just the thinness and inadequacy of any theological explanation that had anything like closure attached to it, or this will end well, or you'll be grateful for, or here's the reason, or I found that thoroughly inadequate. and almost offensive. And in your book, you do provide some theological resources for thinking about suffering. You don't just say it's beyond all explanation. You provide some resources, but they're not closure related. And that the two that you talk about most extensively are, one, biblical images of wilderness, which is a provocative word in the Bible, and the other, mm-hmm. in the story of Hagar in the book of Genesis. And I wonder if you could sort of talk us through both wilderness and the story of Hagar, and I'll mention one other question attached to it. Why not a longer, you know, exposition of the book of Job, which one would think would be a classic case for this kind of instance of depression?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just say first, Matt, I love the way that you have phrased these kind of common Christian messages as ones that kind of close the conversation. 'Cause I think that's right. Often we respond to sufferers' questions in a way that sort of ties them up neatly. This is how it is. This is what God's doing. End of conversation. Which, you know, just doesn't, it doesn't invite any of the real ambiguity that many people feel as they struggle with difficult experiences, but also when they struggle with these really big questions of faith, questions that are important for us to grapple with, but also that we don't have a lot of certainty about. Even the most brilliant theologians don't. And I think it's important for us to learn how to talk about suffering in ways that don't just rush to closure in the way that you're saying. In terms of this wilderness imagery and the story of Hagar's wilderness experience in particular, I came to think about depression as a wilderness experience by really just following the narratives of depression sufferers themselves. I mentioned earlier that, you know, I was seeing how depression sufferers were talking about their own experiences as this sort of displacement into a harsh and unhospitable landscape, into an unhome-like world. And, you know, as a theologian, it occurred to me that the Christian tradition has lots of stories of people who are displaced from home. And find themselves stuck in unfamiliar places and facing tremendous difficulty in living there. And so part of what appealed to me about all this kind of wilderness imagery in the scripture and bringing that to bear on depression was that there was phenomenological or experiential similarities between depression and these wilderness experiences. Another thing that also appealed to me about it was that, you know, if you read even a few of the Bible's wilderness stories, you start to see very quickly that there's a lot of what I call like theological plurality. There's a lot of diversity in what God is doing in these places, why people find themselves there. In that sense, it is a really provocative image. It invites more questions and exploration. It doesn't kind of close the conversation. If you say maybe depression is a wilderness experience, that doesn't settle all of our theological questions. It actually pushes us to explore more. And so that struck me as a theological resource that might serve depression sufferers well. It would invite them to kind of think about, you know, which wilderness experience in the Bible does my experience align with? How might thinking about different types of wilderness stories in the Bible help me kind of process maybe different ways that God is relating to this condition, rather than constraining or delimiting possibilities for theological reflection? It actually opens it up, which I think is such a gift to give to people who often feel very trapped and, as I said earlier, sometimes kind of abandoned by their religious communities. The story of Hagar is the one that I have become so captivated with. in part because it stood out to me as a story that differs from many of these common messages about suffering that we hear in Christian communities. Hagar, particularly in her second wilderness experience, is kind of thrown out, abandoned, and is left in the wilderness without any sort of theological justification or purpose. It's not, there's no reason from God why she's there and why she remains there. And I think part of the reason why Hagar's story kind of stood out to me more than Job, who is another kind of go-to in the scriptures for thinking about suffering, is that Hagar, as far as we can tell in the scriptures, lives the remainder of her life in the wilderness. And there was something about that that resonated with the sort of chronic and recurring dimension of so much depression. Not everybody who experiences depression experiences it for, you know, super, super long periods of time or multiple times throughout their lives. But relative to other mental health conditions, it is quite frequent that that happens. And so there was something about the ongoingness of her wilderness experience that's different from Job that stuck out to me right away. That's one reason, I think.
Okay. I found it very provocative too. And for listeners who may be saying, Hagar, who was that again? It's in Genesis, as Jessica points out, Genesis chapters 16 and 21. She's the servant of Sarah, right? And Abraham has a child with Hagar, named Ishmael, right?
Yes.
So now you make an observation about especially Genesis 21, the second of those wilderness experiences of Hagar's you just talked about. When Hagar is convinced that her son Ishmael is going to die, and she's just despairing at the thought. And I thought this was really moving what you wrote. I'm going to quote it here. The revelation of God in Hagar's story is not limited to God's presence and concern for suffering. It also discloses a God at work in Hagar's situation of suffering. God's presence results in new possibilities for life when God opens Hagar's eyes to a well of water. Whereas Hagar did not perceive this vital resource, the opening of her eyes allows her to hydrate her dying son and presumably continue to live in the difficult terrain of the wilderness. Now, that's a great insight into that chapter. And I guess this is a personal question. Have you found this to be true in your own case? Have you found that God has provided you with a way forward in situations of depression when you otherwise didn't see a way forward? And if so, I'm wondering if that experience helped you build or change your faith, whether you could infer from it a meaning of grace, or, you know, did you find that whatever grace you felt in the moment kind of receded as you felt yourself overtaken again by this feeling of depression? I guess as I'm asking about how durable you felt God's grace was for you in experiencing depression.
Mm. Yeah, my kind of gut response feels rather dramatic, but it's honest, which is that, you know, sometimes I stop and think about my life today as a theologian, my teaching, my research, my life, you know, my family life, my personal life, my friendships. It's not an exaggeration to say that virtually all of this felt impossible to me when I was really, really depressed. Like every aspect of my life that I kind of take for granted as ordinary now was at a time impossible. I couldn't read. I you know, couldn't sustain some of the basic things that I needed to do to take care of myself as an adult, or maintain friendships and things like that. And so I feel in a very real way that, part of, of coming out of the worst of the depression that I experienced was the small emergence of possibilities that I could not access in the worst of my depression. In one kind of small section of the book, I talk about this as sort of like small agency, small gestures of small efforts that sort of I began to access that helped me sort of return to something like normalcy that I had known prior to this really severe depression. So I very much identify with this experience that I see in Hagar's story of kind of having my eyes opened to things that I needed, that I desperately needed, but could not access on my own. And I think in terms of the long-term effects of that experience, I think it has helped me understand some of the very central claims of the Christian faith in a more radical way. I think about things like, believing that life comes from death, believing in the resurrection. I mean, these are things that I grew up hearing about, but to have gone through an experience where I could not see beyond my depression, and then to have an experience where even in the smallest ways, possibilities that I didn't foresee emerged, that to me is resurrection. Ivani Gabara, this Latin American feminist theologian, talks sometimes about everyday resurrections, I think about this emergence of possibility that I did not foresee like that. And I think it's reframed for me in a much more radical sense what I say I believe when I say I believe in the resurrection.
That's really powerful. And that really resonates for me. When I had my bout of pretty severe, depressive symptoms, I'll call it, and it lasted for a while, I know that I could not bear to read. I and what it was for me is reading. I was a graduate student, okay? That's where I was in life. And the focus and intensity that it took to think, you'd get into these texts and the brain would turn on, but when it turned on, it went right to a place of pain. It's like, I can't go there. I can't, I shut the thing back down again so as not to experience that. And the experience of time was so awful because I know tomorrow will come abstractly, but in my experience of it, I can't get past this hour, And so this sense you're talking about of how you gain a new perspective onto some of these really core paradoxes of the Christian vision, that death or that life comes from death, that the resurrection does not happen without death, right? You can't just kind of blissfully glide right past it, right? And that's, I find that really profound, Jessica. Thank you for that. I'm looking, we got a few minutes left with here. One of my favorite parts of your book was your discussion of Rowan Williams' insights into tragedy, right? Now, unlike comedy, which ties together loose ends and brings things to a happy resolution, tragedy causes us to face the reality that some situations offer no easy resolution, that there are limits to how much we can understand, that we have to learn to abide in mystery even when that mystery is painful. I loved that part of your book. How did you light on that insight? Was that born from your experience, or did you read this later and say, hey, that reminds me of my experience?
I think it was through reading Williams and other folks who were turning to tragic narratives as a sort of guide for thinking differently about suffering in a Christian frame that helped me arrive at this. And I think it stuck with me, and I continue to gravitate towards these texts probably because it did resonate with my experience in some way. But you know, there's a, you may know this, there's a really interesting body of literature in theology of people who work on suffering who are saying, you know, so much of the sort of modern Western cultural mindset pushes us to fix suffering, to explain it, to sort of tie it up with a bow, like I said earlier. And there is something about the comic worldview that that aligns with that. And so often the Christian story is told in this comedic frame, you know, bad stuff happens, but then the resurrection, as we were just talking about, it can just elide all of the struggle and the mystery that is also very real in our lives and in the Christian story. Yeah, Rowan Williams is brilliant, I think, in his kind of extended meditation on tragedy and the ways in which it is amenable to the Christian story, insofar as we are called to dwell among the mystery, not to you know, abandon hope, or not to to abandon the search for understanding, but to learn how to sit with these nonsensical realities of our lives that we just can't explain.
Yeah, I love that part of the book. I love the entire book, Jessica. I really got to say, it's such a beautiful book, and it's got so much good, clear thinking about such a difficult subject. I mean, it really is a great accomplishment. Let me ask you a couple of last questions here. At the conclusion of your book, you advocate for mental health care and for a collective resistance to the stigma of mental illness. Do you see improvements in our society's attitude toward and approach to mental health?
I do. One of the gifts of teaching undergraduate students is that I talk all the time with this younger generation. I am inspired and blown away by just the difference in their comfort with talking about mental illness, with their desire to address it more head on, both in their own lives, but also collectively. They think this should be talked about more. It should be addressed without shame. That gives me a lot of hope. That said, I don't know if I have seen a huge change in kind of changing the kind of broad scale social structures that need to change to actually make our churches and our country here in the United States more amenable to the reality of depression in people's lives, which is why, for example, I talk about the need for kind of healthcare reform that makes mental health care accessible to people in all places, of all income levels, all of that. I mean, you know, we have made tremendous strides in treating mental illnesses like depression, but so many people cannot access treatment that helps. And to me, I feel like that is something that we need to address much more. And I actually think Christian communities, churches, faith communities more broadly are in a sort of great position to do some of that collective work, because that's the kind of thing that, you know, one person with good intentions can't solve or address by themselves. We need to sort of build coalition and organize in order to change those things that make such a substantive material difference in the lives of people who are struggling in these ways.
Hear, hear. Yeah, absolutely. No, good. I may it be done, right? Yeah. And it takes a lot of actually work to get that to happen. Yeah, it's just how things work that way. Let me ask you this then, as a last question. If you've written such a thoughtful book about this difficult subject, if there were something from this book that you'd most like to communicate to people who suffer from depression, and perhaps to those who love those who suffer from depression, what would that be?
I think to people who are suffering with depression, I would want to say that I'm sorry that it's so hard right now. And I suppose I would want to bear witness to my own experience that, as I said earlier, I once was dead and now I'm alive, and that happens. That can happen. And I would encourage people to hold on as best they can as they wait for that and work for that. To those who are accompanying those who are suffering, one thing I find is that people feel, as you said earlier, so uncomfortable often with other people suffering. And I think people feel overwhelmed often with mental illness because they feel like it's such a challenging thing to deal with. And there's so much information now and people don't know where to start learning about it. And people feel like if they don't know everything about a condition, they can't help the people that they love. But one of the things that I have encountered over and over again, as I have listened to the stories of folks with depression, is that some of the things that made the biggest difference for them were just people accompanying them in love. And that doesn't require mental health expertise. people just need to be loved and to be accompanied. That is something we all can do. We all have that in us. And that's something we can do right now.
That's great. Thank you. I really appreciate that perspective. And hard-earned, but I think you got a lot to offer to people, given your experience, given your scholarly understanding of this subject. Great book. The book, again, Dust in the Blood, A Theology of Life with Depression. Jessica, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much. And best of luck with your important work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.